Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about strategies for implementing reader-writer locks. We were looking at how we could do it using monitors. It's also possible to do it using semaphores, but we didn't show that. And we mentioned that we had this choice we needed to make. Well, we didn't need to make it, but we probably wanted to make it about when we have two options as to what kind of thread to wake up. And because they were different options, we had separate condition variables for them. How do we make sure that we choose what makes the most sense? And we had different choices. We had this reader priority version and this writer priority version, depending on whether we wanted to let the reader go first or the writer to go first. And we saw that we implemented that choice by changing our conditions for waiting. And that meant we needed to both change when we woke up threads and what the loop they had for waiting was checking in order to implement that. Then after we looked at that example of using monitors, we talked about deadlock. And we mentioned that deadlock, like, it involves threads. It most often involves locks, but it's a type of hanging that can happen with any sort of resource which behaves enough like a lock. So we need to have that mutual exclusion property and this waiting property, which locks are very well known for, but we've seen in other places, like with how pipes deal with when I'm writing to a pipe and there's not enough room, you know, we have to wait for room, we're going to wait for room, and someone is responsible for freeing up that room, kind of like when we don't have a lock, we have to wait for the lock, and someone is responsible for unlocking that lock. And so in both cases, we can have this deadlock problem if the someone who's responsible for releasing the resource, the lock or the space in the pipe buffer, etc., is actually waiting on us somehow. Or we have this circular dependency. And we talked about how to avoid deadlock, and our strategies for avoiding deadlock were to look at these requirements for deadlock and to break one of them. So if we break the circular dependency, and this was, I said, the most practical strategy for locks by choosing a consistent order that avoids deadlock. If we don't hold and wait, if we just give up when we can't get a lock rather than saying, I'm going to wait until it's free, that avoids deadlock. And we had some other solutions like that. And when we finished up last time, we were talking about detecting deadlocks. Mentioned that when we had non-divisible resources, like locks, you either have the whole lock or none of the lock, then we can construct a graph, and we saw this graph had edges from things which were holding resources, that is responsible for freeing them eventually, and things which were waiting for resources. And when we drew that graph, we would see a cycle. We could just look for that cycle and figure out that a deadlock happened, and this might be useful for at least debugging. And if we had divisible resources, we mentioned, well, that's not actually going to work. An example of divisible resources is memory. I can have half of memory. Another thread can have half of memory. And maybe a third thread is waiting for half of memory. And it's more complicated because that third thread that's waiting for half of memory is arguably waiting on both of the threads or neither of them, because it could complete if either one of them completes. But it matters that, you know, that those two threads aren't both waiting on the third thread. So there's something else you'd have to do if there were divisible resources. We won't talk about the details. I just want to make sure you're aware that, you know, sometimes it's more complicated than cycles. And in the event you come across a case where you need to handle that, you can look up how to do it and realize that you're not going to just find cycles. So questions about this before I move on for today? So some minor logistics things. So on the quiz this week, or from last week, I made a mistake in the code in the semaphore output question. Some people noticed this on Piazza. I don't respond because I don't give clarifications on the quiz until after it's due, because some people take it early and I assume they don't plan on looking at it again or have time scheduled to look at it again, nor should they need to do that. So there's an x greater than 1, that should have been x greater than 0, so I just updated the quiz to accept either of the results for the question exactly as written, in which case none of the select all that apply were correct, or the one if you corrected that, which it seems like maybe half of the people did. Another logistical issue is I know that some office hour waits aren't great. And I've tried to like shuffle our TAs a little bit, but there's only so much I can do because like not every TA is going to be available at 7 p.m. on Thursday. And maybe there's some things we can look at doing with queues or something like that. It's tricky to get to make things better. I would like to note that not all our office hours are used evenly. So, for example, I've had way fewer people in my office hours than I would have expected. Maybe this is because I'm scary or give bad help. I don't know. But I also know some of the morning office hours and other times, which, yeah, have gotten less people than we would expect relative to the times people seem to be complaining about. Now, I know this might have changed since I last talked to my TA, so maybe different times are busy. But just be aware that like you don't have to go to the office hours at 7 p.m. on Thursday and assume all the other times don't exist, if that's what you're doing. Also, you can ask for help elsewhere. Like if you have questions with code, you can ask a private question on Piazza or something like that, especially if it's a very specific question. That would be, you know, acceptable. Okay, so with logistics things, I'm going to finish up talking about visible resources since I kind of rushed through this last time. So we gave this example where we had these three threads where we had a thread, you know, with our split memory where each of these threads is looking for some amount of the memory and we see that we have this case where this is not a deadlock because once thread three finishes, everything's fine. But it would be a deadlock if we make some minor changes, like thread three's waiting for thread one. Then it's a deadlock, and that's not entirely obvious. Or if we had slightly less memory, it's also a deadlock. And this means, as I mentioned, we can't rely on cycles. So there's an alternate algorithm. The intuition for the algorithm is it simulates what would happen. Now, let's say we talked about deadlock detection, and it seems like, you know, kind of an impractical thing except for debugging. Like, it's useful for debugging. Be useful if your debugger had a tool which just said, you know, my program's hanging. Is it a deadlock? If so, tell me what deadlock it is. That's certainly a real reason to do deadlock detection. But there's other reasons people do deadlock detection, and this is often to resolve the deadlock. So databases actually use this strategy where they'll detect a deadlock, figure out some way, something that's involved in the deadlock, and fix it, typically by stopping one of the threads. So you say, this thread is holding these resources, let's kill it and undo what it was trying to do. We'll retry it later. So that's a real strategy you can use to resolve deadlock. And databases like it because often databases are taking queries from the user where it's hard to arrange for other deadlock prevention strategies to work. Like it's hard to ensure you acquire locks in a consistent order when the user is writing down a list of steps to do. So questions on deadlock detection. Okay, so that's most of our talk about threads. And since we've talked about threads, I want to talk about not using threads. So there are going to be two strategies we're going to talk about that aren't about using threads. And I'm mentioning these primarily because often they're the better choice. Often threads, because of things like deadlocks, and race conditions, and so on, aren't actually the best way of writing a program, even in cases where it seems like you really want to use threads for one of two reasons. And we mentioned these two reasons when we introduced threads. So one reason is concurrency, that we have multiple things we want to do at a time that are part of the same overall goal, like running a web server. So they're connected, they have shared data, but they aren't actually things where we want to take advantage of like doing different parts of the same task faster than we could with one thread. And with things like servers, often we don't really even need multiple cores. So if you think of a web server, we can process a lot of data on one core, and a web server is actually pretty busy if it's outputting more than a gigabit a second, which we should certainly be able to handle on one core these days for many types of websites, maybe not all of them. So we don't really need multiple cores. So it would just be nice if we could have one thread that handles multiple connections. And the reason why this isn't the intuitive solution of having one thread handle multiple connections is because when we think of handling a connection, we think of read from the web browser, write to the web browser, and these read and write operations typically wait. And we really want to say, I want to read from all these different web browsers at the same time. And if our web browsers are each represented by a file, that doesn't work. We don't have a read from multiple files system call. So how do we do that? And the typical programming strategy is that we're going to have what's called an event loop. So we're going to have some new function which is going to handle this, how do I read and write from multiple things at the same time? And the way I'm going to model this is I'm going to say we have something which gives us an event. And the event is going to tell us what happened, and it's going to tell us when we can read from each web browser. So we don't have to read from one and hope that it has something right away. We'll get this event saying, hey, there's a new connection, you can get one right now, or hey, there's data on this connection, you can read it right now. And this will wait for events on all the different, in the case of a web server, all the different web browsers that are connected to us all at once from one thread. This is just a different system call API. So this leads to this sort of structure of code that we have this one big loop, we get this event, and we have handlers for it. And because we have multiple connections, we need to look up our state for the connection. Whereas in our single-threaded version, we're going to just keep that around locally, that we're going to read a command, store that in a local variable, send the output for that command. That's not how we're going to be able to structure our code anymore with this programming style. We're going to instead have to have this structure that represents a command. So to show that concretely, here's some hypothetical single-threaded code where we get, have a server, we get a file descriptor that represents someone connected to our server, some web browser connected to a web server. So we have a command, we read the command, and we call read several times, so we make sure we get the whole thing. In this case, I'm figuring out if I have the whole thing by looking for a new line at the end, just what I've chosen. Then I figure out what type of command it is, and eventually I'm going to send the response. This is my single thread code. And we can't use this as is with the event loop style, because we need to go back to the event loop before each read and each write. So we have this loop here where we call read multiple times. Each of those is going to block. With threads, that's great. When it blocks, we switch to another thread. But with event loops, we don't want to do that. We want to instead wait for next event rather than waiting for this read to finish. And the event will tell us, now you can read. And now it's going to be fine. So in order to handle the event loop running this code, we need to stash things that are in local variables here into some structure. So here I have this bunch of local variables. So if I'm converting this to event loop code, I might represent each connection with all its state that I previously stored in local variables. And this way, I can do a little bit of this code accessing the structure and then go back to it later in a completely different function and still have the data around. So questions? This, how I made this struct, and a high-level view of how we're going to use it. Yeah?
So the idea is that if one of these reader writes can't complete, we can come back to it later because we haven't stored in this struct?
Yeah, so the idea is that if this read doesn't if we can't read right away, we can come back to it later. So what we'll end up with is some function like this, which will do one read. And the event loop will tell us, we'll get that wait for next event call, will tell us, now you can read. And it's going to work out. So we'll do one read, and we'll figure out, do we actually have a command? And if not, we're going to wait again, and this is going to be called again when we have the rest of the stuff to read. Whereas previously, I would loop and try reading again to get the rest of the command. Here, I don't do that. I just say, the event loop will tell me when I need to read again, when I'm able to read without waiting. And therefore, we have this struct where we store the command that we're putting together. And another thing we need to do is we need to deal with that wait for next event function by telling it, hey, I should start reading. I'm not reading anymore. I need to write now. So it tells us when we can write and when we can read, only when we care about reading or writing. So in this case, I'm not going to ask, can I write until I read a command, because there's nothing for me to write. And I don't want to keep running code saying, yeah, you can write now, why don't you write, if I have nothing to write. But after I have something to write, after I've computed my response, I'm going to do that. Okay, so questions? So we can look at this code and see it corresponds to our original code that meant to use threads, but we sort of break out of where we had previously had loops and go back to the event loop. So we have this loop here. We run one iteration per call. We have the code that was after the loop, which we just put as an if statement that also undoes waiting for reading to undo end the loop, in effect. And we have our code, which starts writing. We don't write right away. We just say, hey, tell me when I'm able to write. Because write might wait until we can write. Okay. So questions? So to implement this, we need that wait for next event function. And that, in fact, exists in POSIX. So there's a function called select and a function called poll. And these both take a list of file descriptors that you want to read or write and wait for them to be readable or writable and tell you which ones were. And there's many OS-specific sort of variations on this. So there's the extra call, and that's just the get wait for next event call, so you can program in this style. And often, this is easier to deal with than writing the multi-threaded version, just because I don't need to worry about locking if I only have one thread, right? I have mutual exclusion already. And if I don't need the performance of multiple cores, that's not going to make a difference. This might even be faster because I have less context switching and so on. I have some other things are more complicated, but we've saved on some overhead costs with threads. So that's one way of avoiding threads. Now, this assumed that you had no way to use multiple cores. So we'll get you a way to use multiple cores. But first, questions on event loops. Yeah?
What does it mean where you said wait for them to be read or writable without reading?
So when you call select, you can say, I want to read from file descriptor 3. And when select returns, you can check its return, how it returns to say, if I call read on file descriptor 3, will that return immediately or will it cause me to wait? Answer your question? Okay, good. Other questions? So if you want to use multiple cores, another sort of strategy besides threading, where in threading we have variables. We like have global variables or pointers to the same thing in multiple threads, and that's how we share data. So another model is that we can send messages between either threads or processes. And this is a very popular model. So one reason is that it works in cases where threads don't, on hardware where threads don't work. If I have multiple machines that are physically separate, I can't really have shared memory efficiently. And big so-called supercomputers generally have that sort of architecture. It's not been for a long time that a machine someone would call a supercomputer isn't actually multiple machines put together in some way with independent memory spaces, so you can't actually efficiently share memory. And also, it's an easier model to program, at least some would say, because like you don't have to worry about race conditions as much. It's like more straightforward when data is moving between threads. This advantage is we might be copying more things than we would otherwise, because we have to send messages. Sending messages probably involves copying them from one process or thread to another. So commonly, the APIs for this will have a send and a receive. So here, for example, I have thread 0 sends work to a bunch of other threads and waits for a reply from each of those threads later on. And you can think of this as kind of like we just have pipes to all the other threads. That would be, in fact, a way you could implement this if you wanted. Now, from a high level, this seems like, well, you know, this seems like maybe harder to work with, but there are often elegant ways of doing things where you want to divide up a problem into multiple pieces and solve it in parallel. And to give an example of that, let's talk about doing life with message passing. So we're going to split up this task into multiple processes, and rather than having them share this grid, they're just going to send the parts the others need. So to think about this, first we need to figure out how do we divide up the grid. I'm going to propose dividing it up like this, which is probably similar to what many of you did in the assignment, or should do if you haven't handed it in. And we're going to say that each process is going to store cells in the part of the grid that they own. And let's think about, for process 3, what does it need to do to compute the new values? Well, it needs all the values around those cells. So it needs this red shaded region that includes its cells and a little sliver from process 2 and process 4. So to make this work, what messages do we pass? Well, we have process 2 and process 4 can pass that little sliver in a message. They can just write down that sliver of cells in a message, send it to process 3, and that's what it needs. And we can have the same thing happen for process 3. It can send process 2 and process 4 that little sliver of its cells, because that's what it needs, rather than sharing the whole grid. And this sort of pattern often comes up, and this is why message passing is not like as hideously inefficient as you might think. You might think, oh, if you want all the threads to work together, they have to copy all their stuff. Well, they have to copy this teeny piece of stuff, not everything. And that's usually what ends up happening. Okay. So questions about message passing? Yeah. Where's process 1? It's up here, and we're not dealing with it. This example. Yeah.
Can you say message passing? How exactly will that work? Or I guess we're about to get into it.
So I don't have I don't have much lines on this, but like the API is send process number message, which could be like a string or a byte array or whatever. So I've glossed over the details of how do we encode these messages, because depending on your message passing system, that varies a lot. So yeah, that's message passing. Okay, so now that we've talked about not using threads. We're going to move on to our next big topic, which is virtual memory. And for this, I need to talk about prereqs to make you understand what I'm doing here. So in CS3330 in COA 2, we talk about virtual memory for a while. And for CPEs, the prereq for this class is not CS3330 or COA 2. It's ECE's embedded class. Now you might think, CS3330, that title, computer architecture, and COA 2's title is computer organization and architecture. So why is it embedded? Because there's a class called computer architecture in CPE, an ECE class, but it is not the prereq for this course. Yes, that's kind of surprising. And we might say, okay, well, at least, you know, we tend to talk about virtual memory. It's in the catalog description of 4414. So presumably, that means that, you know, that same sort of stuff is covered in either the embedded course. And the answer is maybe a teeny, teeny, tiny little bit, maybe, or the architecture course, and maybe a teeny, teeny, tiny little bit is my understanding. So we're going to do a perhaps more thorough review of virtual memory than I would do if everyone had actually taken 3330 or COA 2. And for some of you, you will have seen this stuff before. For some of you, you won't have. So sorry about that disconnect. That's just how things work out. Presumably, this will change in a couple years when whatever happens with the new curriculum happens. So virtual memory goes back to something we mentioned briefly earlier as part of processes, which is address translation. That we want two programs that are running to be able to have the illusion that they own all the memory. And the way we implement that is that when we use context switch to program A, we set this mapping for its memory that's going to be implemented by the hardware. So program A can only access its code and data and not program B's code and data. And better than that, because we've set up this mapping, when program A is running, we can put its code and data at any address we want, even the same address that program B thinks its code and data is at. And you've probably been used to running with systems like that, because if you've seen like the typical memory layout, you know, like where the stack is and so on, like in 2150, like we usually just put it at the same place all the time. And if we have multiple programs running, the only way we can make that work is with something like this address translation, where two programs can say, well, when I use address 7000, it goes here, and go to different places. That allows us to like put that wherever we want. So virtual memory is a particular way of making these mappings work that we're going to talk about, and we're going to have some assignments with later on. So we're going to talk a lot about things we can do with virtual memory in the operating system side, but first I'm going to talk about like what is this mapping, how does it work in the hardware, and the OS is what configures this mapping, which is why this is a big operating systems topic. And there's going to be a lot of things we can do by configuring this mapping in clever ways. So to talk about this, I'm going to start with a toy example. So I'm going to say we have a program which has 10-bit addresses. So here's our program. It has 10-bit addresses. So this is the entire address range. And I'm saying we're splitting it up. So the bottom fourth is its code. The next fourth is its data, like its global variables and its heap. The next fourth is space to make the heap bigger, but it's going to start out empty. But so we need to alloc more memory. That's where we're going to put it. And then we have its stack. And we're going to divide this up into pieces to help us construct that mapping. And I'm going to call each of these pieces a virtual page. And I'm going to number them starting at the lowest address to the highest address. And these are going to be the same size pieces. In fact, they're going to be exactly a power of 2 size. And in this case, I've chosen them to be 2^8 bytes. We'll see a bunch of different sizes. XV6 uses one particular size. that will be true to the 12 bytes, but this toy example, we're keeping everything small. And we call them virtual pages because virtual is the name we're going to use for the addresses the program sees. We're going to use the term physical for what they correspond to in the real hardware after we do the translation. And because I've chosen a power of two size for these pages, that page number, that numbering from 0 to 3 inclusive, is actually just the high bits of the address. Just because we're dividing by 2 to the 8, we have to chop off the last 8 bits. And that's why I number them that way, because now we have a very convenient way of getting the page number, in particular a way that's going to be convenient in the hardware and in our operating system code. Yeah, compared to if I chose like 17, that would be very inconvenient in the hardware. It would be kind of convenient on our OS code because we divide, but that divide would be pretty slow. Now, I have these top two bits are our page number, you know, after we chop off all the stuff corresponding to the size of a page, we'll call the bottom part the page offset. The rationale for this name, page offset, is that if I think of an address 180 in the middle of here, it's halfway through the page. It has a page offset, which is half of the maximum possible value for the page offset. Of an address 1FF, it's way up here. It has the maximum page offset. It's the maximum part of amount of the way through the page. So the page offset says where in a page you are. So questions about how I've divided up addresses? Okay, so I have this way of dividing up the program's memory, and I'm going to do the same thing to divide up the real memory. So in this toy example, our real machine has more addresses than the program can access as what we call physical addresses, addresses that are actually implemented in the memory, because it has 11 bits instead of 10. But we're going to divide up these physical addresses in the same way. So I'm going to number them from 0 to 7, divide them up into pieces of the same size. And then I'm going to choose, well, for each of these virtual pages, what physical page am I going to use for it? So I'm just going to, in this example, draw a few lines. So I'm going to say, if you're accessing something in one of these addresses, it's going to use one of these addresses. And it's just going to be a one-to-one mapping. So all zeros is going to map to the first address in that physical page. You know, and 0, 0, 0, and a 1 is going to access the one after that, and so on. Now, when our operating system is doing things for our hardware, there's not actually a draw a line instruction. So we're going to need to represent this in some other way, and we're going to use what's called, you know, a page table. So we're going to use a table. So our table has a row for every virtual page with the physical page that corresponds to it. And it's not going to be required that our page table is actually complete. We can say, well, remember our original mapping, we said that this was empty slash space for extra heap, like if I malloced more things. We don't have to assign that to anything right away. You can just leave that as none because it's not allocated. We'll talk about what none actually means, because you might observe that we have to store this in bits, and none is not a value of some bits, so we need some other convention. But we're going to represent this table somehow, and that's much more straightforward to write down. And this is the information the operating system is going to give to the hardware, but the hardware is going to interpret to implement this mapping. Questions about our basic page table? Yes?
Will physical address memory always have more bits than?
The question is, will physical memory always be bigger than virtual memory? No. It can be the same size, or virtual memory could be larger. So in XP6, it turns out they're the same size. On a typical current laptop or desktop, virtual memory is usually bigger. So all of them are possible, and in fact, I can point to real machines which had all the possible versions. So the last 32-bit machines often had bigger physical memory because you wanted to have more than 4 gigs of RAM on your machine, even though you had a 32-bit processor, and 64-bit processors typically have a bigger virtual address. Okay, so I have this table here, and we need to represent that as bits. So I need to do a little extra work to deal with this none value. So what we're going to do is we're going to have an extra bit for each row, which is valid or not. So none is going to be represented by a valid value of 0, in which case we'll ignore all the other bits. Otherwise, we'll have a valid value of 1, and the other bits will be the physical page number. So the top bits of the physical address, that piece of memory we want to use. And the hardware is going to have this table that's written by the OS, and it's going to use it every single time a program uses an address. And I mean every time. Function calls, reads, moves, reads and writes. Every time, you know, stack accesses, going to use this mapping. And the CPU is going to split up the address into the virtual page number and the page offset. And it's going to look up the virtual page number in this table, so it's going to take the correct row, and it's going to extract this valid bit and this physical page number. And when things go well, it's going to take this physical page number, plop it together with the page offset to get the same location in the physical page that we had based on the virtual page. So we're going to the same place in that little box, just in physical memory instead of virtual memory. And we also have to check this valid bit, and we need to do something if it's not valid, if there's none. And the action we're going to do is we're going to trigger an exception known as a page fault. And one of the things that many OSs do on this exception is somehow cause your program to print out the message segmentation fault. There are many other things we can do, and we'll talk about them over the next several weeks. So we're going to call this thing that's looked up a page table entry. So the whole thing is a page table. Each row is going to be a page table entry. We will sometimes abbreviate this as PTE. We have our virtual page number where we figure out what row. We get our physical page number from the page table entry, assuming it's valid. If it's not valid, well, there's going to be something there, but we're not going to use it. And we have our page offset, which we copy unchanged. Just where in that page do we want to go? Does the program want to go? Okay, so questions about this lookup procedure? Okay. So given that, let's switch to real sizes. So 32-bit x86, that's how x86 runs, has 2 to the 12 byte pages, or 4,096 bytes. So given that, here's a virtual address, split it up into a virtual page number and a page offset. And let's say I do my page table lookup for this, and I get physical page hex 998. What's the physical address we're going to have at the end of that translation I just showed on the previous slide? I'll give you 30 seconds to a minute. Check with your neighbor. Who would like some more time? Okay, so first thing I want to figure out when I look at this problem is, well, I know that because our page size is a power of 2, that the top bits of our address are going to be our page number, the bottom bits are going to be the page offset. And I want to figure out how big one of those is. And if the pages are true to the 12 bytes, that means I need 12 bits to figure out where in the page am I. If I had one byte pages, I need 0 bits. If I had 2 byte pages, I need 1 bit to figure out am I the first or the second. If I have 2 to the 12 bytes, I need 12 bits. So that means the bottom 12 bits of the virtual address are going to be our page offset, and everything else is going to be the virtual page number. And conveniently in hexadecimal, every hexadecimal radit is 4 bits. It can translate directly to binary. So the bottom 3 are 12 bits. So this means our page offset is 0x123, the bottom 12 bits. And everything else is our virtual page number. Questions? In fact, now to figure out the physical address, I'm going to take this page offset, and I know we put that page offset as 12 bits, and in front of that 12 bits, I put my physical page number that I got. So I'm going to get 0x998123, so this is the 12 bits. And then we have our page offset. Some of you might say, how many bits is the physical address? It doesn't change the answer, but it means that there might be some leading zeros that I don't write down, because when I write down the number like 17, I don't write 000017. I write 17. So don't need to write any of the leading zeros, even though there might be some that we didn't talk about. So questions? Okay. So that's solution. Now we have our overall sort of page table layout. Let's think about how this works with 32-bit x86. So I've told you that this is how we split things up. And conceptually, you might say, this is what's going to happen. I take my address from the CPU. I get the appropriate row in the table. We also have some extra bits here that we're going to use later. So in addition to a valid bit, we're going to also check read or write OK. So we're going to have some other information. We'll talk about how we use that later. But a big observation is that this table is actually pretty big, that we have one row for every virtual page. And with a 32-bit address, we have 12 bits here, which means that if the whole thing is 32, the rest left over is 20. So that's a 20-bit virtual address, which means we have 2 to the 20 entries, And if each of those entries is like a modest 4 bytes, that's 4 meg for every program we're running. And that's just a little bit too big. And this is the 32-bit version of this problem. If we think of the 64-bit version, gets real bad. So we're going to have to figure out, where do we store this? And you know, when I looked at the earlier tables, you might say, well, the processor just going to have some special memory or something. That's not going to work. And also, like, what format do we store it in? We don't want to store it in this flat format. No, there's no place we really have enough memory to make that make sense. So there's going to be two things we do. So one is we're going to keep it in memory. So page tables are going to be stored in physical memory. Just to make it work out, we're not going to like store them in the processor directly. We're just going to store a pointer to them in the processor. And that pointer is going to contain a physical address, not a virtual one, because if it contained a virtual one, how would we look up the physical address for it? And to make this fast, processors have a special cache, or set of caches, for page tables. This is not an architecture course. We're not going to talk about the details of how those work, but it is fast because of caching, like most things involving memory. And we're also going to save space. So 4 meg, we could store that in memory, but it still would be a problem. So we're going to use a tree structure, and a particular version of a tree-like structure. And by doing this, we're going to avoid storing invalid entries. And this is going to work out because we have these large invalid regions. Like if you think of a newly started program, like you could malloc 10 gigabytes on, or you know, something like that, but that memory isn't allocated right now. We don't need to store a bunch of entries that say, it's invalid, it's invalid, it's invalid, because you haven't expended your heap yet. So we're not going to. And we're going to use a tree structure to let us omit big chunks of entries. So let me show you what this tree structure looks like in XV6. So XV6 has two-level page tables. So the first level is going to be what you tell the processor about. So the processor is going to get a pointer, pointer in special register. That points to what we'll call the first level page table. And this contains not the actual page table entries that tell us where the program's data is stored, but what we'll call first level page table entries that point to another page table. And each of those other page tables contains a subset of the virtual addresses. So these are each in the x86, 32, each 2 to the 10 entries. So these are 1K entries. And the page table entries are 32 bits. So each of these are 4 kilobytes. Now, this only saves space if we don't have to store all the possible second level tables. If we do, we're using more space because we have this extra pointers to them. And the way we handle this is that when we have these big invalid regions of memory, we're going to say in the first level, hey, there's nothing to look for here. It's all invalid. Don't worry about it. And because we can usually have these big regions of memory where we can do that, this is going to end up using a lot less space for most programs. Not all programs, but most programs. So our first level table, we're going to have these ranges, and we're going to have a physical page number, but rather than being the final physical page number, it's just going to say, where's the next page table? That's where you go. And we have a physical address, because if we had a virtual address, where would we look it up? So it has to be a physical address that the hardware gets to see. So we have this bunch of values, these pointers using typically a page number. We also have valid bits, like we saw earlier, to indicate holes. But rather than saying this one virtual page doesn't have a mapping, it maps to nothing, it says this whole range of addresses of virtual pages maps to nothing. And now we're representing that way more compactly than that flat structure I started with. And that's why this is worth doing. And we use this valid bit instead of like a null pointer because every possible physical address is valid. So we have to have some extra information to do that. Okay. And then these point to a second level table. So our second level table, in this case, this pointer in the first level table pointed to the second level table. So it starts off not at virtual page number 0, but at wherever the pointer was for, and it has entries for each individual page, so we still have that granularity that we started with. So we can still do each page maps to something different, and we can still have pages which don't map to anything in the middle of this if that's what we want. Some questions about this two-level page table structure. Okay. So something else we're going to have in this structure is we're going to have some extra metadata bits about what the program is allowed to do. So as the processor is doing this lookup, it's also going to check, hey, are you trying to write? If so, I'm going to see if you're allowed to write. And if not, I'm going to raise an exception. Or are you allowed to access this from user mode? If so, I'm going to allow it. Otherwise, I'm not. And this is a tool for the operating system to control what the program can do more precisely than it can just do by making it be able to access or not access memory. So we've seen this two-level structure. I have a brief aside about naming. So there are lots of names for the different parts of that picture. So you might see the first level, what the page table base register points to, or the address we give the processor to start out figuring out where things are, as either the first level page table, the top level page table, or this term that XP6 uses because Intel uses it, page directory. And the first level page table entries point to the next level. I will usually call that the second level page table. And Intel, just an XV6 sometimes, because we aren't very good at being consistent about terminology in computer science, sometimes just calls those page tables because they call the other ones page directories. I will try to always use the term first level page table and second level page table, but if you're reading the XV6 source code or the Intel manuals, you might see page table just used to mean the last level only and page directory used to mean the first level. Or there's like two more terms if you're talking about 64-bit x86. They decided when they were adding extra levels that maybe you might want to like have a naming with numbers. They didn't do that. They have like a different name for the directory of page directories for historical reasons, I guess. So just naming note. So if we think about how this works out with our page table lookup, we have these page table entries, which we now know are stored in memory, and we have a two-level table, and we use the bits of our virtual address to look up things in this table. So the first 10 bits are the part of the virtual page number that tells us which top-level entry, which first level do we use, and the second 10 bits tell us after we found that first level entry, which second level entry do we use. And the last 12 bits are the page offset, where in that page, physical page that we found at the end of this lookup is the program trying to access. And XV6 sometimes needs to actually deal with this. So in the header mmu.h, XV6 has some macros that are just for dividing up addresses in this way. So there's the first level index, the second level index, and the page offset, and they have a macro for extracting the first level index by doing bit shifting and anding, and the second level index by doing bit shifting and anding. You could also do it manually. They just have written this. And also for constructing, given a directory index, table index, and offset, computing an address. And one way that might be handy to view this pictorially is that, you know, have our base register and the CPU, and in XV6 we have these 10-bit part that is indexes into where that points, which gets us the next pointer, which the next 10 bits index into, and then we get our physical page, and that's where the program's data actually is. Questions. So now we've talked about structure, let's look at this question. So let's say I have our XV6 page table layout. I have this virtual address, hex 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and my base pointer, so this is the location of my first level table, is 1000, that's a physical address because we can't use virtual addresses until after we've done the lookup. We can't do the lookup without that pointer. So it's a physical address. And I'm telling you that the first level page table entry contains physical page number hex 14, second level contains 15. And my question is, what is the address of the page table entries? And remember that each of these page tables is just an array of these entries. It's just a flat within the table. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree about what's going on. Someone get me started. No. So a good first step is to, like looking at this picture, divide up our virtual address into these pieces. So we have our page offset, which is this last 12 bits. And then our first 10 bits and our next 10 bits are the first level and second level index. So I want to convert those. And in this case, I need 10 bits, which is not divisible by 4. So I can't just like read off several hex numbers. I need to do something more. So I'm going to write out this is the virtual page number that needs to be split into two pieces. So in binary, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. I've just wrote out the hexadecimal as binary. And our first 10 bits of this, because we have 32 bits in total, are here. Our next 10 bits are here. So the value of these first 10 bits is, if I convert back to hex, that's our first digit, that's our second digit is going to be 048 for the top part, and 3, 4 and 5 for the bottom part. So questions on how I got that? Okay, so in my first level, I'm going to use this index to go into the table. And the first level, first entry of first level is at 0x1000, because that's where the base pointer is. The second entry is at 0x1004, because the entries are 4 bytes. And the first entry is index 0, because that's the lowest possible index we could have. The second entry is index 1. So I'm going to take this 048 and multiply it by 4 to get the actual offset from the beginning of that table. So 0x048 times 4. And we know that we can actually shift this value over. So we get, I believe, I'll do this with a calculator because I don't believe in doing math wrong in front of people. So it gives us 4, which is going to be 0x120. So the first level address is 0x100 plus 0x120, which is 0x1120. Yes?
Why did you do times 4 and not divide by
4? Because if we had index 1, we go, the first entry, index 0, is at 1000. Second entry is 4 bytes after that, because each entry is 4 bytes. So that it's an array.
Is the index?
So the index, that's an index into an array, is how you should think about it. It's an array of 4-byte values. Okay. And for our second level, we're going to take 345 times 4 the same way and base it on the base address for the second level, which is this. So it's PPN 0, which means base byte address for the second level of 14000. And we add 345 times 4 to that, which is going to be D14. So times 4 is 0xD14, assuming D14. So the second level page table entry is going to be 0x14D14, because we looked up, it's in physical page 14 based on the first level entry, so that starts at 14 and offset 0, page offset 0, that's 3 zeros, and I added D14 to that. So that's where I found the second level page table entry, which contained physical page number 15. To get my final address, I combine that 15 with the page offset, so this is physical address of 0x15678. That's where the actual final result of the memory access is. So questions? I went through this. Yes?
So the way that we get the base byte address for the second level page table is you shift the physical page number over by the number of page offset.
This question is, the way I got the second level base address is by shifting the number I got from the first level by the number of bytes in the Page offset, yes. One way of thinking about this is that this is an address, but it's in units of pages. I'm just converting it to bytes. So like if I tell you, like I have a value 10 ints into an array, and I ask how many bytes into the array, we're doing the same conversion. I'm telling you I have a value hex 14 into the beginning of, into memory, pages. And I went, how many bytes into memory is that? Okay, other questions? Okay, so going through this, because in the operating system, we need to figure out these intermediate addresses because we might need to write things to them to change a program's mapping. It's actually something that's going to come up a whole bunch of times. And in fact, XV6 is going to have utility functions for helping you do this because it comes up a lot. Okay, so now that we know about the layout, let's talk about how things are, you know, how big page tables are. So I mentioned that the reason we save space is that we don't use all the entries. So how much space do we actually use to store page tables? And note that we have 10 bits to look up each value. That means we have 2 to the 10 entries. And you might say, maybe we can avoid storing entries because we're not using them, but we can't because the processor is going to read that entry anyways and try to use it. So we have to have all the entries have something there, even if it's just marking them as invalid. So given that, first question, how big are the page tables of a process if it has one valid page? So everything else is inaccessible. What's the size that they have to be? And if we have all the pages populated? Who has, anyone have, people want more time? So I'll start with the, so the first one, it's going to be in, let's get the answer in units of pages, so pages are 4K. So is it, who thinks we have 4 kilobytes of page tables? 8 kilobytes of page tables, 12 kilobytes of page tables, 16 kilobytes of page tables, some number I haven't talked about. Okay, for the first answer. Okay, so most people just have no opinion, which is interesting. So the way I like thinking about this is, let's think about, we know we have at least the first level page table. We can't omit that or else everything doesn't work. And that has 2 to the 10 entries. So that is 2 to the 10 times 4 is 2 to the 12 bytes. So it turns out, and this is not a coincidence, this is by design, page tables in 32-bit x86 are exactly one page at each level. So we have one first level page table that we have to have no matter what. So that's going to be true for both of these. Now, to have one valid page, that means that we have to have at least one entry in that first level which is valid, because there's at least one address that the processor will look up and find something. And because that's a valid entry, it needs to point to a second level page table. We can't point directly to actual addresses, so we need another page table. And that's the same size, it's another page. So that gives us our first level table and one second level table. And that means that we're going to have two pages, so 8KB or two pages of page tables, and one actual page of data that those page tables point to that the program can use. That's sort of the minimum we could possibly do. So if we have all of the pages allocated, then what we're going to have is we're going to have a base pointer pointing to our first level table that still takes up a page, but now we want everything to be valid. We want every possible entry in there to be valid. And assuming we don't allow duplicates, which technically is possible but usually doesn't make sense, then each of them is going to point to a different second level table so we can have different memory for every page. So we have 1,024. This is 2 to the 10 entries. And each of those 2 to the 10 entries points to, a different second level table. So there is 2 to the 10 second level tables. So we have 2 to the 10 things that are one page big, and one thing. So we have 2 to the 10 plus 1 times 4k. Or a little over 4 megabytes. So questions? How I... Yes?
Where are you getting the 2 to the 10 from?
We have 10 bits to look up in the first level, and each of those points to a second level table. So we're multiplying by each of those things it points to is 4 kilobytes, so it would be 2 to the 12 kilobytes of second level tables plus 4 kilobytes for the first level. So if I have the numbers in pages, but you multiply by 4k for each page. Okay, some questions? Yeah. Why is there only one first level? Because we give one pointer to the processor and we get the top of the address, and there's only one, that's all we have to look up in the first level. Everything else happens with later levels. And because there's only one place to start, but with the second level, we have one place to start for each entry in the first level table. Okay. So before we finish up, let's talk about, we talked about page tables generally, and we're going to start talking about how they work in XV6. So first I want to talk about how does XV6 set up the page tables for a program. And XV6 does this thing which is very common among real OSs, and that it divides up the memory into two halves. So we have this split at this address kern base, where everything above that address is for use by the kernel only. And these are virtual addresses, but they're configured in the processor to make it so if we're running in user mode, they're not accessible. So these blue memory addresses are going to be set up in the page tables as, hey, processor, if someone tries to access this and we're not in kernel mode, make it cause an exception. I'm going to kill the program instead of letting that happen. And this is where XV6 stores all its information about like what processes are running and so on. Like the P table, it's in there. And in XV6, this is mapped one-to-one to physical addresses. So 8000000 is physical address 0, 800010 is physical address 10, and so on. And this is just convenient. Now, you might say, what about user addresses that are in the green area? Those are mapped as convenient, depending on how much memory the program needs. And this means that there are two mappings for all the things programs can access. There's one in the green region for the program to use, and some extra mappings for the kernel to access more directly. You might say, why would we have this second mapping? Well, when we have to do things like set up page tables, we need to go from a physical address and write to it. And even in the kernel, we need to use a virtual address to do that. This makes it convenient for us to get a virtual address. And we'll see that a whole bunch when we talk about how do we set up these page tables, how do we allocate memory for programs. This is going to come up to be really convenient for that. That's where I'll leave off today.